Hello, welcome to The Moment That Made Me, this time.
Everyone was caught slightly with their trousers down, quite frankly, because this wasn't on the menu at all.
The man who led 3 Commando Brigade to victory in the Falklands War.
So the Navy were getting ready, they'd forgotten to tell the Royal Marines. So the box marked Mission Impossible was opened, and we were told to get on with it. I mean, you don't normally get called to war from your bed. The middle of the night.
The moment that made Major General Julian Thompson came in the early hours of the 2nd of April, 1982.
I was commanding the 3rd Commando Brigade. My rank was Brigadier. And it was the second year of my command. And I just got back from Denmark, where we'd been wrecking an exercise. And when I got back, my staff said, hey, there's been a bit of a problem as far as the landing, which isn't going to involve us. I thought, all right, let's go to bed. So I went to bed and woke up at 1 o'clock in the morning by my boss, Jeremy Moore, saying, you know those people down south, they're about to be invaded. Bring your brigade to short notice and sail on Tuesday. This was Friday. So a bit of a tall order. That really made me because it was a shock to be woken up at night and told you're going to war now. Get on with it.
And what were your initial feelings and thoughts when you got this news?
Well, my initial feelings, I say, were horror. We were totally unprepared. And also horror that my staff weren't there. I just said to one of my staff who was already back in England, I said, get the others back. I don't care what you do to do it. Get on to them in Denmark, wake them up, shake them, and tell them to get back ASP.
Can you remember the moment you went to bed? And you said you heard there'd been some trouble in the South Atlantic, but you obviously weren't really kind of taking it that seriously in terms of your involvement. But how did you go to bed that night?
Well, I went to bed that night thinking I was going to go and have a big conference the next day, which is why I'd come back from Denmark with a whole lot of people who were going to talk about our exercise program. Of course, that all went out of the window. And the trouble was actually the reason I discovered was that we didn't know was though the Navy were getting ready, they'd forgotten to tell the Royal Marines, which is rather silly when part of the game was to take back the islands. How are they going to take it back without the Royal Marines? I have no idea. Anyway, that was their problem. And it was also our problem because we had to get a hustle on the next day. This is 2 o'clock in the morning, okay, on the second. Actually, they hadn't invaded at that stage. They were about to invade. They because of the timings being later west of us, they didn't start invading until about 2 or 3 hours after I was woken up. Now, what had happened? So the Navy had got the buzz because the First Sea Lord, Henry Leach, had been looking at signals a day or two earlier and had realized that the Argies were about to invade. And he went down to the House of Commons to beard the Secretary of State for Defense, and he was ushered into Maggie Thatcher. And he went in to overhear the Secretary of State and the Foreign Office saying, if they invade, there's nothing we can do about it. And he chipped in and said, yes, there is. And she said, what? So he said, prepare a task force, give me the authority. Well, a task force would be useless without the Marines. Unfortunately, they forgot to tell us for some reason.
How could they forget to tell you?
Well, I don't know. I don't know why, how they forget. It was just bad staff work, I suspect. And everyone was caught slightly with their trousers down, quite frankly, because this wasn't on the menu at all. War in the South Atlantic wasn't part of the game. There were no contingency plans whatsoever because the MOD had done a study about 6 months earlier, which came up with the conclusion that if the Argies invaded, there was nothing we could do about it. So if it's going to be Mission Impossible, there's no point in making a plan. So the box marked Mission Impossible was opened, and we were told to get on with it. That was it. And of course, the first thing we had to find was, how are you going to get there? By sea, okay. So you need ships. Then we had a thing called the Red Book, which told us exactly what ships were suitable. But of course, in the Red Book, it said whatever it was, and the Red Book was absolutely useless because the ship you wanted was off Panama or somewhere like that, or in the middle of the Pacific. So you just had to take whatever was available. And whatever was available was the nearest ship. And you just said, sail it to Bristol. Where's the nearest depot? Wherever it was. Tip all the stuff in their stores. 17,000 tons of ammunition in the stores we had to take down. So it was a hell of a lot to do. Luckily, the RSC, or rather RCT transport, TA, laid an absolute blinder. They mobilized all their truck drivers, so there were literally hundreds of trucks rushing around the country delivering stores to the various ports. And I was then standing, this was on a Tuesday, I think, on the helipad at Plymouth Stonehouse, where I was based, and with one or two people ready to fly out to the ships. They were out in Lyme Bay. It was very foggy. Helicopters clattered in out of the mist. We climbed in, went away, and then we eventually saw the welcome sight through the fog of the wake of Fearless, the ship we were going to join. We joined her and plonked down on the deck, and there we were.
At that point, did you feel prepared? Were you ready?
Well, I was ready as I could be. I mean, we were very silent that first day, sort of sitting and eating our meal, thinking, what the hell are we doing now? Just getting ready. And it all started coming together, because actually the brigade I commanded was a jolly good brigade with a super staff. They were ready for just these sort of things. I didn't really have to worry in the end. In the end, it became just routine.
Just routine. But have you ever actually had to do anything like this before?
No, I hadn't. I'd never. I mean, I'd done lots of amphibious operations. I had exercises. I missed Suez to my fury. I was doing a course. So I hadn't done an operational landing ever in my life, and nor had most people. I mean, I suppose there were about four of us in the brigade who had, who'd been at Suez, older fellows. I mean, Suez is 56, 70, this is 82, a long time earlier. And but we got together, and we knew what to do, because we'd done loads of exercises. We knew exactly what we were meant to do and how we were to do it, and it all worked out well.
So what was the feeling like on board as you set sail? Because you said it started off very silently. Can you talk me through the journey a bit?
Well, the first supper I sat down to with the captain of Fearless, great Jeremy Larkin, was a great chap. He was a nuclear submariner and commanded Fearless. He was a brilliant CEO. He got a DSO for his work out in the Falklands. And Mike Clapp, who was my naval opposite number, because an amphibious operation is the responsibility of two people, the landing force commander, who was me, and the amphibious group commander, who commands all the amphibious ships. Because you can't say to him, you know, I want to land here, and he says, sorry, mate, there's reefs there or something, you can't land. Or, I want to land you here, that isn't any good to me. It's a compromise, and usually a slight, everyone did give and take. There's got to be a bit of give on each side and a bit of take. Otherwise, it's hopeless. Luckily, I knew Mike well, and we got on well. He was terrific. And so we had a good team, and we felt we were in a winning situation. Then I acquired, three para came to me because they were ready to come. They came. It was great to see Hugh Pike. He'd been a student of mine at ILCO. He'd been a student of mine at Camberley, where I'd been on the staff at the Army Staff College. And then we heard we were going to get two para under H. Jones. And I thought, this is really the first 15. I mean, a brigade of consisting of red and green berets is unbeatable. We're going to beat the hell out of these guys. And we did.
So you arrived full of confidence?
Arrived the other end, yes, absolutely. Yeah.
It was a 10-week conflict, and you are credited for leading the land forces that retook the Falklands. Can you just talk me through your role?
Well, my role was to A, plan and conduct the amphibious operation, and then to get on with winning the war. The way we did that was by producing a route across. We decided to come in the unexpected direction, down through the north, not through the south, which is the way that they expected us to come. And I didn't want to do the operation on Goose Green. I was going to do a raid on Goose Green to make them think that we were interested in going that way. It was actually they were interested in going over the top a different way. And unfortunately, this raid had seized upon the minds of the people back in Northwood, who are our headquarters. And I was summoned to the phone by John Fieldhouse, who was the CNC, who said, why did you cancel the raid on Goose Green? I said, it was becoming a distraction from the main aim. We were using time and helicopter. I didn't want to do it. He said, you're going to have to do it. We needed some victory. So I said, okay, we'll do it. And I got really angry, actually. I went outside, I remember, and said to myself, I'll win the war for these buggers, and then I'm going to resign. I didn't, actually. But I was really pissed off. Sorry to use my language, but I really was. Anyway, we did it. And, of course, H. Jones and got a VC as the parachute battalion, did a fantastic job. But I under-resourced him because I didn't believe in it. And I under-resourced them, and it was my fault that they had so many casualties. I got it wrong. I did get it wrong, there's no doubt about that. Anyway.
And H. Jones, famously, who lost his life in the battle for Goose Green. Had you ever in your career before then been asked to take men to fight and potentially lose their lives?
Oh, yes. I mean, I'd served in what I'd call counterinsurgency operations before in my life, in Egypt in 1954, in Cyprus, two tours there in the Troodos Mountains, up against the Oka bandits. I'd lived in a monastery for 6 months, not as a monk, but with my platoon. And then I served in Aden, and I'd also been on the staff during the Borneo campaign. So I was aware of what I call counterinsurgency. I'd never taken part in a proper war before, as indeed had very few people in my experience. I mean, people of my age, and lots of other people originally had. I mean, chaps, when I joined, I only joined 7 years after the end of the Second World War. So a lot of my immediate superiors had fought in the Second World War. So I was used to their philosophy. I think I learned a lot from them. And I learned a lot from the battlefield tours I did in the Staff College, particularly from a wonderful man called James Hill, who commanded 3rd Parachute Brigade, whose favourite cry was, "Gentlemen, do not be dismayed if chaos reigns, could chaos undoubtedly will reign." He's dead right.
How did it make you?
Well, it made me because it made me, I think, do something serious. And it sort of shaped my life forever after, really.
How has it shaped your life?
Well, it's sort of, I live with it in a sense that I keep in touch with a lot of my old soldiers and Marines. We had a reunion the other day somewhere down in Poole. And, you know, it's really great to see these guys. They're all a bit old and shaky now, but like I am. But they're wonderful. And when you love them, actually. If you don't, you have no business commanding them. You should love your men. Otherwise, you shouldn't command them.
Earlier on in our conversation, you described it when you got that call as being mission impossible. I mean, it could have gone very differently, couldn't it?
It could have gone very differently indeed. It could indeed have gone differently. And, for example, had they sunk one of our carriers, we would have been pretty well fixed then. Their Air Force was incredibly effective and brave. I take my hat off to them, actually. I really do. Because they attacked and with unrelenting thing down what we call Bomb Alley and they call Death Valley because so many of them were shot down. Their Air Force was the most dangerous thing. I really wanted to get ashore as quickly as possible so to clear of those little swines. I mean, they really, when I say swines, I admire them tremendously, but my God, they were dangerous.
It's really interesting that you talk with respect about the enemy in the Falklands conflict. Have you yourself actually learned something as a person about the nature of war or mankind itself through this experience?
Yes. You don't hate them. And I'm quite friendly with them, and we keep in touch with some of the opposition now. There's no point in hating them. They're just doing their job like you are. And provided they don't commit atrocities. I mean, if they had done that, we wouldn't have liked them at all. But I'm quite friendly with them now. I have several Argentines who occasionally, from time to time, email me and we keep in touch, particularly the one who I... When I pulled up in Stanley... I was met at the door of what was their headquarters by a very smartly dressed Argentine officer who said, "What do you want, Brigadier?" He also recognised my rank badges. Turned out he'd been to the Army Staff College 2 years before the British Army Staff College. He was the expert on the British Army. and I said, "Is my boss in there, my general?" He said, "No, but mine is with two officers." And I knew who they were. They were Mike Rose and the interpreter. And I didn't want to walk in on this gang and say, you know, "Hey, here I am," and spoil rapport that I hope was being established between these two. So I walked away and found a bed for the night with two para in a house that was they'd requisitioned.
And that was the moment. And that was the moment when the actual surrender was being negotiated.
Yes,
you went to indeed. Find a bed with two para.
I went with two para, and I was listening to my radio operator used to switch his set to the BBC World Service every night and on HF, and we picked it up, and I listened to the BBC World Service describing surrender negotiations being conducted 800 yards away from where I was, from 8,000 miles away as I was hearing the news.
It's interesting that you chose, of all the things that happened before, during, and at the moment the Argentinians actually surrendered during the conflict, that the moment that you chose was the phone call. It wasn't the battle for Goose Green. It wasn't the battle for Mount Tumbledown. It wasn't the moment that they capitulated in Stanley. Why that particular moment, the phone call? Why is that the moment that made you?
Well, it's such a wake-up call. I mean, you don't normally get a call to war from your bed in the middle of the night. It's a fairly unusual thing to happen. There's no warning at all, nothing. You just go to war, boom, like that. It just, and that sort of jolted me into reality, I think. That's why I chose that moment.
Do you, when you rewind and think about that night or the early hours when you got that phone call, the way you reacted, that the mission that you were set, have you got any lessons that you can share with us in how to rise to the occasion when you get that kind of thing?
Well, I think the lesson is to have a good team. My goodness me, I had a good team. And I wouldn't be able to do it by myself. There's absolutely no doubt about that. And the lesson is that it's James Hill's lessons. Gentle Missouri is made of chaos reigns. Chaos undoubtedly will reign. It did. And I remember my company commanders, I had some very experienced company commanders who'd fought in the Dofar War. And they said to their companies, be disappointed if chaos doesn't reign. Because it did. It just, you've got to work through it. And the guy who wins is the guy who sorts out the chaos quicker than the other guy.
Do you miss the chaos?
No.
Major General Julian Thompson, fab to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Kate, lovely to talk to you too.